The recent collapse of multiple banks has led to worries of another financial collapse, perhaps even worse than 2008. We're going to look today on what is happening, what it means, and where do we go from here. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage people to smash that like button, subscribe to the channel, but don't hit the notify bell because you have a life outside of the internet. Also, you can follow Crisis Magazine at Crisis Mag at the various social media channels, Twitter, Facebook, MeWe, Gab, Gitter, I don't know, the other ones as well. Okay, so the banks have been in the news lately and not for good things, and typically banks aren't when they're in the news. It's not for good things. There's been a run of, there's been a run of banks recently that have either collapsed or been taken over or shut down. And it's got a lot of people worried about what this means. Is this going to be a repeat of 2008? Is it going to be something worse? What do we see from here? So let's go through that a little bit. First, I want to talk about what has actually happened. This has all been in this month. So in the month of March, basically, 2023 is what we're talking about here. So on March 8th, Silvergate Bank announced liquidation. Now, Silvergate Bank was not a large bank. It wasn't that big a deal when it happened. It had exposure to the FTX organization that went under, the cryptocurrency organization that went under, had exposure to that. And it led to a bank run. I mean, there's been, people have suspected that Silvergate Bank is in trouble and likely will liquidate for a few months now after the FTX debacle. And so the fact that it basically led to a bank run and it was liquidated on March 8th wasn't that big of a surprise by itself. However, then 2 days later on March 10th, 2023, Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, basically. Now, Silicon Valley Bank was the 16th largest bank in the United States. It's also the second largest bank to ever fail in United States history. The largest bank, I believe, was Washington Mutual in 2008, 2009 back then. But Silicon Valley Bank was a relatively large bank. I mean, it's not one of the big boys like Bank of America or Citibank or something like that, but 16th largest. And however, it was somewhat of a niche bank. It was a bank specifically for Silicon Valley elites. And it was created, I mean, basically its business model was helping tech startups in Silicon Valley and helping them out, being the bank for them and also being giving them loans, things like that. So that's where its exposure was. Now, why did it fail though? That's the big question. And really, it had nothing, at least apparently, some of this, by the way, a lot of this information has not yet been completely released about exactly what happened in all these situations, but I'm going on what we know. It didn't seem like it failed because of its connection to Silicon Valley, to tech companies or anything like that. But essentially what happened was it's because interest rates going up. Now, this is something we need to understand because this is a problem for all banks, essentially, in the United States. For over 13 years, interest rates for banks have essentially been zero. That's free money. And so they've operated in an environment for a very long time of zero interest rates. And so what happened was, is that they then make decisions based upon that fact. And so, for example, not too long ago, they were getting bonds that were at 2%, treasury bonds and what have you. But then they loan out those out. Then when interest rates get higher, they then get caught holding the bag. Because what happens is that their clients want to withdraw their money so that they can get better rates elsewhere. And so this hurts them greatly because now all of a sudden you have a situation in which a large percentage of their clients want to withdraw their money, which is known, of course, as a bank run. Now, this, I'm going to take a step even further back. Bank runs only happen in a fractional reserve system. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is this. Now, I guess maybe everybody listening to this knows this, but maybe not. The bank does not hold your money. That's something that you should learn at a very young age. I make sure my kids know that when they get to be teenagers and they start having bank accounts, I let them know the bank does not hold your money. When you go in there and you give them your first paycheck and you deposit your $500 or whatever it is in there, they do not keep that $500 in their bank. It's not like all of a sudden they have a vault in the back where those $500 sit. And when you want your $500 back, you go in there, they go get it out. That's not how it works. A very, very, very small percentage of the money that is deposited into bank is kept with the bank. It's actually more complicated and worse than I'm saying, because ultimately what they do is they loan money. They can loan money on fake money is probably the best way to put it. If you give them $1,000, they can loan, I think it's like $10,000 off of that. But it's even worse than that, because then of that $10,000, they can loan off of that as well. So essentially, it's a big Ponzi scheme, the entire banking system. But it's supported by the fact that everybody has faith in it. And everybody has faith in it mostly because of FDIC, which is Federal Deposit Insurance something. Which what that is you see that you go into a bank, you see the big sign says FDIC insured up to $250,000, at least $250,000. What that means is, let's say you have $10,000 in the bank and the bank all of a sudden goes under. The federal government, essentially, yes, it's more complicated than that, but I think for purposes today, we'll just say the federal government basically ensures that you will get your $10,000 back, even if the bank goes under. And they will do that up to $250,000 that you have saved at the bank. So if you have up to $250,000, all of that is protected by the full faith and credit of the United States government. And in fact, you could even have, if let's say you have $500,000 that you want to save in cash for some crazy reason, you can have multiple bank accounts at multiple banks. So you could have one bank account with $250,000, another bank account with $250,000. If both banks go under, you still don't lose any money. You get your whole $500,000. And so essentially, this has allowed people to trust the fact that they can keep their money in a bank that's backed by FDIC insurance. So they feel comfortable. Most people feel comfortable. This is why you can have a system, a banking system, in which very little of your money is actually kept in reserve. Almost none of it is kept in reserve. It's all out there being loaned out, being used for mortgages, being used for credit cards, various different reasons it's being used out. Because the what is happening is you're giving the bank your money so they can make money off your money. And then they make money off the money that they make off of your money. And it just continues to go on. So like I said, it's essentially a Ponzi scheme. So to get back to Silicon Valley Bank, what we have is a situation where they have a bunch of money out there at the low interest rates. So that's all they're getting paid. But now all of a sudden people are leaving them because they can get higher interest elsewhere because interest rates have gone up. Basically, these long-term loans they have are being called because of better situations elsewhere. So this is because this is crazy because for so many reasons, but it really shows how we've lived in an artificial environment for a very long time, artificial financial environment, but particularly the last 13 years of zero interest rates, essentially zero interest rates that the Fed has set it at zero interest rates, because they do that because they want people to spend more money to bolster the economy. That's why they have these zero interest rates out there. But eventually what happened was the reason that interest rates finally were raised last year is because inflation was going up. Because they pumped so much money into the system after 2008, after COVID, that eventually inflation started going up. And the way that you break inflation is you rise interest rates. I'm talking about, of course, a managed economy like we have here. I'm not talking about the free market. In a free market, this stuff would happen naturally. But in our managed economy, what essentially happens is that you have to raise interest rates in order to break inflation. Why is that? Because like I said, when you have low interest rates, people are more likely to want to spend money. You're more likely to go buy a house, right? if you can get a low interest loan, you're just going to spend more money. If you can get a cheaper home equity loan, you're going to be more likely to, for example, add on to your house, take a vacation, do whatever with it. You're going to spend more money if money is cheap, i.e. low interest rates. But if you have that also increases prices because more people are competing for the same goods. And so they're willing to spend more. So if you raise interest rates, people spend less, prices in theory would go down, inflation therefore goes down. That's a very high level explanation of it, but that's essentially what happened. So essentially then Silicon Valley Bank got caught holding the bag. They did not have the ability to handle this, and so they collapsed. Now, the truth is, though, this is a danger for every bank. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank, they collapsed I don't know exactly why they specifically were the first to go, but this is not something that is isolated to just them. And so ultimately, there's a lot of banks that are probably in a very similar situation to Silicon Valley Bank. My guess is it might be because Silicon Valley Bank had so many like tech entrepreneurs as their customers, they were more savvy and the more likely to see the problem and the more likely to pull their stuff out. Whereas if you're like, you know, a bank that a lot of your customers are mom and pop shops or grandma, stuff like that, they're not going to pull their money because interest rates go. They're just like, I'll just keep with what I have. But the more savvy investors, they might have all pulled, more likely to pull out, and that caused the bank run. Now, what's interesting is when this first happened, the Treasury Department, Fed said, we're not going to bail out Silicon Valley Bank. But then they did. Now, they claim it's not a bailout because they know the word bailout has bad connotations from 2008. But essentially what they did was they said, they're not going to bail out the bank. Like, in other words, they're not going to keep the bank going. So Silicon Valley Bank will cease to exist at some point if it hasn't already. But what they're going to do is they're going to bail out all the depositors, including, here's the important point, including those who have more than $250,000 there. So if you're a tech firm, let's say, and you have $1 million in your bank account at Silicon Valley Bank, which isn't that big a deal for a medium-sized even tech firm. You don't have to be a huge company to have $1 million sitting around because you need it for payroll. You need it for expenses, stuff like that. That's not like that much money. Well, you're going to be protected according to the FDIC. And so what happened was, is they basically said, okay, we're going to bail out the rich is what they're doing because most people don't have $250,000 or more in this. And so they're going to bail them out. They're also bailing out these companies. Now, some people might say, well, that's a good thing. Because these tech companies, they go under, they really kind of drive our economy. They're innovators and things like that. The truth is, if they have a great idea and a great company, they'll survive or they'll get started over again by somebody else. So it's not necessary to bail them out. Because here's the thing. Here is the consequence of that. By bailing out all the depositors, by guaranteeing all the depositors at Silicon Valley Bank that they'll be right, that their money is protected, what the Fed has essentially done is it's guaranteed all deposits in the entire United States. Because do you really think they're going to bail out Silicon Valley Bank, and if another bank next week goes under, they're going to say, no, for you, we're only going to protect up to $250,000. Of course not. They know that now they have to guarantee an unlimited amount of money at all these banks. And so that's nationalizing the deposits is essentially what it's doing. It's nationalizing our bank system so that the government basically is just guaranteeing all deposits. Now, a bigger issue with that is, of course, where does this money come from? Because essentially, I have this here. Right now, okay, just to explain FDIC, what happens is every bank, when they receive money, they have to put a tiny percentage of that in the FDIC fund for potentials like this, because banks do fold at different times. This isn't something that's never happened before. But usually what happens is it's a small bank, another bank takes it over, everything just keeps running. But FDIC does have money in it. It has $130 billion in it. That sounds great, right? $130 billion, that's going to cover a lot. The problem is there are $22 trillion in deposits in this country. $130 billion that you have saved up for a rainy day, but you could potentially owe $22 trillion in deposits. And so clearly, that's a Ponzi scheme again. That is going to fall apart if there's enough people needing their money or wanting their money, losing confidence in the banking system, which is what we're seeing. So that's what happened on March 10th, Silicon Valley Bank. 2 days later, this one's the funny one. This one, something's weird with this one. Signature Bank in New York was shut down by the Fed, essentially. It's the New York State Department of Financial Services. Shut it down on March 12th. So 2 days after Silicon Valley Bank went under, Signature Bank was shut down. This is the third largest bank failure in U.S. history. So Silicon Valley was the second largest. Signature Bank is the third largest. Now, here's the difference here, though. They were shut down. They did not fail. They did not go insolvent. Basically, they were shut down. So why were they shut down? Now, the reason was given, one reason that was given was that they weren't giving, that there were some problems with their data that they were giving. Something like funny with their books. Another reason was, but of course, the fact is a lot of banks have funny books in them and they don't get shut down. Another reason was like they wanted to prevent a total collapse. They were afraid of contagion is what economists like calling it. The idea that these problems would spread, which makes no sense as well, because you literally have a bank shut down and 2 days later, you shut down a bank. That seems to foster a more chance of a contagion, of it spreading. Now, here's the part that is interesting. Actually, there's two parts interesting. First of all is Signature Bank was heavily invested in the cryptocurrency world. And a lot of people believe, and there's evidence to believe this, that it's because of their involvement in crypto is the reason they were shut down. Because the feds, the financial system, the legacy financial system does not want to help the cryptocurrency industry. It's a direct competitor of theirs. And so they don't like the fact that a bank was supporting cryptocurrency businesses, helping them, being involved with them. And so they basically shut them down. And the reason people believe this, first of all, because of the fact they were one of the few banks that is heavily involved with crypto and they were shut down. But also, they basically said, when a bank shut down, another bank's going to take it over. And basically the Fed said, yeah, whoever bank takes it over, you can't take over the crypto part. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. That another bank came in, I can't remember the name of the bank, I don't have it written down here. Another bank came in and assumed all the deposits, meaning they're taking responsibility for all the deposits, except the cryptocurrency company deposits. They're just screwed. Now, I guess if they're under $250,000, that will be covered by FDIC insurance. I don't know that for a fact, but I assume that. But this bank is assuming all the deposits, meaning no matter how much it is, they're going to make all these people, they'll cover them. Of course, again, they're covering them fake in a fake way because they don't actually have that money. They're just saying, yeah, well, we'll guarantee that you guys will get paid. No, you can withdraw all your money, but not with the cryptocurrency companies associated with them. So that's a sign that it's likely the financial industry, the legacy financial industry, just was very uncomfortable with Signature Bank's work in the cryptocurrency world and decided to shut it down because that's essentially what they did. So now there's these cryptocurrency companies that were a Signature Bank have to now scramble to find a bank. But what other bank is going to handle them? Because they know they just saw Signature Bank get shut down. Why would they now get involved in cryptocurrency? So it's going to be very difficult for cryptocurrency companies to have banking relationships. And I think this is on purpose. Another weird thing about Signature Bank is one of the members of the board of Signature Bank is Barney Frank. Now, those of us of a certain age know exactly who Barney Frank is. He was very well known during the Clinton administration and later. He was a congressman. But he is the co-author of the Dodd-Frank Act, which is the Financial Services Act that was passed by Congress and made law after the 2008 collapse. Now, he's retired, but still, how can a man who literally wrote the law regulating banks be allowed to be a member, a board member of one of those banks? That makes no sense. Now, I will say Barney Frank, though, has been upset about this decision. And he's like, hey, we weren't insolvent. We should not have been shut down. This is just an attack on us because we were investing in cryptocurrency. So Barney Frank might be right. But I think that's a little weird, too. But it shows how corrupt our banking and financial system is and how everybody's in bed with each other. So I don't know what to say about that other than that. I think that's odd. Now, okay, that's not it, though. Now, First Republic Bank, it's teetering on the edge of collapse. It currently has a 111% loan-to-deposit ratio, meaning it has more loans than it has deposits. And so its stock has been crashing. And so First Republic Bank is in a lot of trouble. Well, here's what's interesting. On March 16th, this is 4 days after Signature Bank was shut down, eight other big banks gave it $30 billion. Now, think about what normal free market industry would you have a situation where if one of the businesses goes under in an industry, the other, his competitors, then attempt to bail him out. So they give $30 billion to First Republic Bank to try to prop it up. Although I heard that like they had $70 billion in withdrawals. So I don't even know if the $30 billion will be enough. In fact, Jamie Dimon, which one's he with? He's a big banker. I think he's with JP Morgan. He's like, we got to give him more. And so essentially what's happening is that the other banks are supporting this bank from going under, which makes no sense in a free market, but it makes complete sense in our financial world because they know if First Republic goes down, that's going to decrease our confidence in the banking system, and there's more likely to be other bank runs at other banks. Also, that's First Republic. Another thing is Credit Suisse, a Swiss banking giant. They were just taken over this weekend by a rival, UBS Group. And they are a 167-year institution, and they just went under. They actually did very well in the 2008, surviving the 2008 problems, recession. And so that's essentially, they've gone under. They were taken over. So what we see is the banking system is in big trouble right now. And of course, you get all the reassuring words from the Fed, from the Treasury Department, from the government agencies. We're all fine. We're guaranteeing it. But again, like I said, there's only so much you can guarantee. This is all built on a house of cards. So what's going to happen next? Now, nobody really knows. But I would say that a few things. First of all, I do think we're going to see more banks that are going to collapse, be shut down, taken over, something happened to them. Because as was mentioned, most banks are in the same situation Silicon Valley Bank was in that they were basically screwed by the interest rates going up. This really hurt them because they pretended like interest rates will be low forever. I mean, it just shows how terribly they're run, that they don't even like plan for a rainy day. Like, oh, you know, interest rates might go up one day. No, they don't even care about that. They don't even look that far in advance. They don't look 2 weeks in advance. Like, oh, we can make more money right now. Let's do it. And that's exactly what they do. So I think that's, first of all, that I think other banks are going to be a problem. Another thing I would say is that there is the danger that the Fed will only protect the larger banks. They won't protect the smaller banks. Now, you can argue both ways here. They protected Silicon Valley Bank, which was 16th largest, so it's a decent size. But they might realize we can't protect all the banks. But they're going to have the too big to fail scenario eventually. If we have enough bank runs, enough bank collapses, eventually they're going to realize they can't protect them all. They can't guarantee deposits to every bank. And so, but they will see, like if a Bank of America, Citibank, JP Morgan, something like that, if Morgan Stanley, something like that goes down, they will protect all the deposits at those places probably. First of all, it's because that's where their money is. So they're going to protect themselves and their friends. It's all crony capitalism, of course. And so I think ultimately that's a problem because if they do that, basically, it's another situation, just like what happened with the COVID response, where you favor the big businesses and you screw over the smaller businesses. And so it consolidates everybody's accounts at the big banks, which, of course, what does that do? That makes it much easier to control us. We saw in Canada, of course, with the trucker revolt that they started restricting their bank accounts. Well, that's a lot easier to do the fewer banks you have. It's a lot easier to call up your five buddies at Bank of America, Citibank, and the other guys and say, okay, shut down any accounts with these guys. Anybody who's buying and selling guns, for example, than it would be with a bunch of, with thousands of credit unions and smaller banks and things like that. So I think that's a big problem. And of course, but if they don't, so if they just do the big banks, that's bad. But if they do everybody, that's bad too, because they don't have the money for that. So what are they going to do? And so if they bail everybody, that's going to be a problem. And so what we're seeing is that the Fed is in a very much a lose-lose situation. So over, I'm going to pull up a chart here. This is the Fed's balance sheet. If you can't, if you're just listening, I'll explain a little bit. What it shows is it shows their total assets. They're basically their balance sheet. And if you, it goes back to 2021, and you see they went from 7.2 billion up to 9 billion. Wait a minute, is that trillion? That should probably, that's trillion, sorry. They went from 7.2 trillion to 9 trillion from 2001 to about the middle of 2022. But then in the second half of 2022, they started tapering off. This is what we were talking about. They're raising interest rates, and they're pulling back all the money in the system some because of inflation. This is the way that they combat inflation. You take more money out of the system, you're going to have likely inflation is going down, because inflation, by the way, is more money in the system, and which causes then price increases. People think inflation is the price increase. It's not. It's the actual inflation of the money supply, more money. But what we see is at the end of the chart, those who are looking at can see there's a huge spike all of a sudden this month. And they added $300 billion to their balance sheet in the past, like basically couple weeks. Why did they do this? Why did they add $300 billion to their balance sheet when they were clearly tapering down? It's because of the bank runs. It's because they realize they need money to bail out these banks. But the problem is, by doing that, they are going to potentially have inflation go back up again. So they're in a lose-lose situation, like I said. Do they prop up the banking system, which means they increase their balance sheet, they reduce interest rates? If they do that, inflation is going to rise again. And they know that. Or do they combat inflation? Keep rates down, keep the money supply down. They do that, the banking system could collapse. It's a lose-lose situation. My guess is they're going to choose option one. They're going to support the banking system, because for the average person, their bank going under is a lot more scary than prices going up maybe a few percent. Now, of course, the danger is if you continue to do this for too long, those inflation is going up a lot more than a few percent. It's going to really spike. You can get hyperinflation eventually. But I think politically they realize they need to support the banking system. So my guess is that what they're going to do is they're going to start to maybe pull back on their interest rate hikes. They're going to increase the money supply some more, increase their balance sheet so that they can prop up the banking system. Now, what else is going to happen is I think there's going to be and this is related to the cryptocurrency that they were worried about supposedly with Signature Bank. I think there's going to be a push for CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. I've said before, this is probably the thing outside of a nuclear war, which unfortunately is on the table. CBDCs probably frighten me the most as far as how it would impact us, the most people, in the worst possible way. Because central bank digital currencies, what they do is they give complete control to the Fed, to the banks, over your money. They can decide how you spend it, whether you spend it, when you spend it, and who gets it, and whether or not they get to keep it. Everything's under control. I mean, it's a truly dystopian situation where we have a situation of they could decide, okay, we're going to take your money away because you tweeted something. We're going to not allow you to spend your money on a gun. We're going to you get your paycheck, but you have to spend 80% of that money within a month. I mean, all these things are possible with CBDCs. And so I think that's going to be a push, because on their side, they believe it helps them control these messy situations like bank runs, because you can't have a bank run with CBDCs. You know why? They can just simply say, no, you can't take your money out. They just simply shut it off the spigot and they just say, nope, no, nobody can withdraw money right now. And they can control that from a central location. So I think that's a real danger, CBDCs. Now, the question is, what should the government do, by the way? I say it's a lose-lose situation. It is. We've gotten ourselves into this mess, and it's in a very bad situation. Now, ultimately, what should be done is we should abolish the Fed. The Federal Reserve should be abolished. We should end fractional reserve banking. We should end the FDIC. We should restore sound money. I mean, this is essentially what we should do. And the gold standard is the most obvious sound money. Some would argue today for something like Bitcoin, a Bitcoin standard. But the point is that this whole system is a house of cards that will eventually collapse. Now, I've been impressed by the ability of the government to keep it alive for as long as it has. I mean, I think people have been predicting the collapse of this system for decades. And I think they were fundamentally right that it will collapse. I just think there's no way we can predict the time frame of when it will collapse. Like, I thought 10 years ago under Obama and different things going on, I thought, oh, I don't think we have, like after 2008, I was like, I don't think we have 10, 15 more years like this. It's going to get really bad. And it hasn't. I mean, it is really bad underneath, but for the average citizen, it hasn't. So will it continue to last? I don't know. But I think ultimately the only way you fix this is probably things will have to collapse. And then you have to establish a more sound system. And that would basically be get the government out of the financial sector, get it out completely. That's the ultimate solution. Now, the more important thing for us is we can't abolish the Fed, unfortunately. We can't abolish FDIC. We can't do any of those things. What should we do? Now, the first thing is, we have to recognize that, I want everybody to know, this is not financial advice. I do not give out financial advice. I'm just simply stating my opinion of how things look and what are some different options. If you go and do something based on what I said, you're probably an idiot. But if you do and you lose money, that's not my fault. But I would say this, all options are bad. I'm a real killjoy today. I realize it. If you keep your money in the bank, let's say you put a lot of your money in the bank. And this is what an elderly person often does because this is their best option. A retiree, for example, they keep almost all of their money in cash in the bank, in a checking account, a small savings account, money markets, something like that. Well, there's no growth of that money. You are losing money because if inflation's at 6%, let's say, which it's higher than that, and you're making 0.2% on your money, you're losing 4.8%. I'm sorry, 5.8%. Don't do math in your head at home. You're losing 5.8% of your money all the time. And so that's a bad option, but it's probably the best for a retiree because they have a short-term outlook. They cannot plan for 30 years in advance. They might be alive in 30 years, but they might be needing hospice care, something like that within 6 months. So that might be their only option. So banking is not a great option. Another possibility, of course, is stocks. Stocks are a possibility and always have been a possibility, and they're not bad in a lot of cases. However, they're all part of this system. And so while stocks are going up, that is basically, though, just because of the money supply being increased. It's inflation. Inflation increases prices of your goods at the grocery store, but it also increases the price of stock, which means your stocks go up, but it's somewhat of a artificial increase. Because obviously, if inflation's at 6 to 8%, let's say, and your stock is increasing by 5%, you're losing money on that as well, even with stocks. And you're taking a much greater risk than you did with just having your money in the bank. So you do make a little bit more, but you have a higher risk. So stocks aren't a great option to really put all your money in or anything like that. Another option, of course, is precious metals, which are stable. They retain their value, but it's a long-term situation. There's no guarantees that gold, for example, or silver are going to go up anytime soon. It's not as direct as all of a sudden our economy goes under and it goes up. So, I mean, that's a long-term thing, and it's you're not going to have a lot of growth on that. It's also very hard to use. I mean, you have to find somebody to buy your gold if you have gold. Like, I don't believe in, for precious metals, I don't believe in, like, you know, you have these gold holdings with somebody else. The whole point of precious metals is you control it. So if you don't hold it, what's the point? Real estate, that's a very good investment, but that's a long-term investment. That's not going to help you in the short term. So if you have a short-term horizon, real estate's not a great idea. I do think real estate's a good idea in general, but again, that market could easily crash because it's been propped up as well by the last 10 years of zero interest rates. The reason real estate has gone up so much in over the past decade is because of interest rates. So if they decide to increase interest rates, continue to increase them, that's going to hurt the real estate market. Now, of course, I have to say, as somebody noted in the comments, somebody who shall remain nameless, cryptocurrency is also another option. Cryptocurrency is very high risk. It's also long-term. There is no guarantees that if you, let's say you buy Bitcoin today, I don't know what it's at right now. I want to say like 25,000, something like that. There's no guarantees that tomorrow it won't crash down to 15,000. Now, long-term, in the sense of as long-term as crypto has been, it's only been around for 15 years. Long-term, I do think it probably will be a good option. But I'm more pro-cryptocurrency because it's a defense against CBDCs. Because the whole thing is CBDCs are based on some of the similar technology of cryptocurrency, but they're a completely different animal because CBDCs are controlled by a central entity, i.e. the government, the central bank, whereas a cryptocurrency is controlled by nobody, the good ones, like a Bitcoin. So I do think if CBDCs come, our best way to combat it is through cryptocurrency, buying and selling from each other with Bitcoin or something like that, Ethereum or whatever the case may be, whatever the best one is. That is going to be the best way to, first of all, maintain the value of our money, but also to escape from the control of the government. So ultimately, though, what I would say is, I'm going to wrap it up here. Ultimately, I'm going to say is it's a bad situation. It's a lose-lose situation for the Fed, what they're supposed to do in this situation. So my advice to everybody is just a traditional advice that good financial advisors have always given. Be prudent. Don't spend what you don't have. Prepare for the future the best you can. And yes, that's the part that's hard because all these different options for preparing for the future, cash, stocks, real estate, precious metals, whatever the case may be, all have their risk. But do your best. Maybe spread it out. Don't have all your eggs in one basket. Spread it out and do your best. And then be prepared. Prepare also for a major collapse by having ways to support your family outside of the traditional means of a W-2 job. So look into growing things, raising animals, having supplies, things like that. So I realize this podcast probably came across a bit dramatic, a bit sensationalistic, but I really do think we're in a very precarious situation, our financial system is, and we could see a crash that's much worse than the 2008 recession that would maybe even be worse than the Great Depression 1930s. I hope that doesn't happen. I pray it doesn't happen, but we need to do all we can to prepare for it and really work towards the ability to survive such a situation. Okay, well, I'm going to wrap it up there. Until next time, everybody, God love you.